From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. And on this Inauguration Day, it's here and now.
I, Joseph Robinette Biden Jr., do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute.
President Biden was sworn in today as the 46th President of the United States with a call for unity. And he addressed those who did not support him.
Let me say this. Hear me out as we move forward. Take a measure of me and my heart. And if you still disagree, so be it. That's democracy. That's America. The right to dissent peaceably within the guardrails of our republic is perhaps this nation's greatest strength. Yet hear me clearly. Disagreement must not lead to disunion. And I pledge this to you. I will be a president for all Americans. All Americans.
Vice President-elect Kamala Harris was sworn in as the first woman and first Black and South Asian American vice president. This is 2 weeks to the day after an insurrection by mostly white pro-Trump extremists, and just a day after the country marked 400,000 deaths from the coronavirus. Let's bring in NPR political reporter Juana Summers, who joins us now from Washington. Welcome.
Well, hello there.
Juana, the president called for the ending of the uncivil war, that's in his words, that pits red against blue and rural versus urban. What stuck out to you most about his speech?
Yeah, so as a politician, President Biden is someone who has made the challenge of unity, of bringing people together, a hallmark of his campaigns, and that was certainly on display here. It was very evident in the words that he very deliberately chose, that he sought in the speech to begin the process of bringing healing and unity to an incredibly fractured nation. I believe he described this as a historic moment of crisis and challenge. He made clear that Americans are united in the same fight against these swirling crises that the country faces in terms of the coronavirus pandemic that has killed so many Americans, the economic challenges that have so acutely felt by so many of us, as well as the ills of racism and racial unrest that we have seen play out, that this country has been reckoning with for some time, but very powerfully this year. He clearly wants to be someone who is a president, as he said, for all Americans.
And you mentioned the economy. He started with the economic fallout from the pandemic. Let's listen.
Millions of jobs have been lost. Hundreds of thousands of businesses closed. A cry for racial justice, some 400 years in the making, moves us. The dream of justice for all will be deferred no longer. A cry for survival comes from the planet itself. A cry that can't be any more desperate or any more clear. And now, a rise of political extremism, white supremacy, domestic terrorism that we must confront and we will defeat.
Juana, President Trump, I'm sorry, I have to change my language already. President Biden says that he's getting to work right away today to address some of those challenges. He's actually signing more than a dozen executive orders. Can you remind us of what he plans to do?
Yeah, so Tanya, this is the first indications we're seeing of the ambitious agenda that President Biden is pursuing that's going to include economic relief tied to the coronavirus pandemic and overhaul of the nation's immigration system, infrastructure spending, and climate change initiatives. The real centerpiece of this kind of cascade of administrative actions that we're seeing are these measures to combat the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. Those executive actions will require masks on all federal grounds. He'll also ask agencies to extend moratoriums on evictions, as well as federal student loan payment. President has said that this is a pandemic that will continue to get worse before it gets better. And his aides are saying that these executive actions are an indication that this is a dire national emergency and that this incoming administration that gets to work today plans to treat it as such.
I have about 30 seconds or so with you. You know, I think they're saying that this is the first time since 1869 that an outgoing president has not attended the inauguration for his successor. What more can you tell us about how this transition is actually going between those two?
Yeah, that's right. You know, we saw former President Trump, then still President Trump, getting into that helicopter, Marine One, and heading to Joint Base Andrews before heading to Florida, where he will start his life as not the president any longer. I think what struck me the most is after the ceremony that we saw at the Capitol, President Biden headed with that fraternity of fellow former presidents to Arlington National Cemetery to observe the solemn ritual of laying wreaths there. And I think that kind of tells you in very stark images everything that you kind of need to know about kind of the departure that we saw in how President Trump, former President Trump, ended his term compared to the other former presidents who gathered and kind of participated in this solemn ritual and the transition of power that we witnessed here today.
NPR political reporter Juana Summers, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, Democrats now control the White House and both chambers of Congress, but 8 in 10 Republicans say Donald Trump changed the country for the better. And two-thirds of Republicans, two-thirds, according to polls, believe the lie that the election was fraudulent, that Trump actually won. So what is the future of the Republican Party? Jeff Flake is the six-term congressman and one-term senator from Arizona who retired in 2018 and has often been a lone voice voicing concern about the direction of his party. He joins us now. Senator Flake, thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
And as you well know, the GOP lost control of the White House and the Senate, and you wrote an op-ed in the New York Times saying Trump is destroying the Republican Party. Should that be destroyed? Has it been destroyed? Is it time, you know, after an insurrection for a third party?
Well, I wrote that piece. It came out the morning before the insurrection. So I thought that we had plenty of problems before what happened at the Capitol. It's deeper now. So it's going to be very difficult, as you mentioned. A good chunk of Republicans believe that this election wasn't free or fair. The President Biden didn't win it, and that's going to be a challenge. If you don't believe in truth or shared facts, it's really tough to move forward. And for us as a party, it's going to be really difficult.
Well, and what responsibility does your party have? Because in that op-ed, you also accused Republican colleagues of rank opportunism for not standing up to Trump's baseless claims, but also maybe, you know, fueling them. Members like Ted Cruz, who it was said was using those claims to launch his own run in 2024. You know, we saw a video of insurrectionists going through Senate papers saying things like, Ted Cruz would want us to do this, take over the Capitol. Should something happen to them? Yeah.
Well, I think certainly politically, when they try to run for leadership positions or for re-election, that people ought to remember that. I thought that that was horribly irresponsible for my colleagues. Many did not, but so many did amplify the president's falsehoods about the election to go so far as to challenge the vote in the end. And that obviously we have to get past that. And if the Democrats govern anywhere near the center, as I think that they're inclined to do, because that's where Joe Biden is, then Republicans are in deep trouble unless we find a central path somehow, because we're going to be marginalized as a party.
Yeah, well, the new Senate is going to take up Donald Trump's second impeachment trial. I'm imagining you'd want to see him convicted, meaning he can't run again. Should we assume that?
Yes, I think he'd have a hard time running again, but he may not know that. And he does have support and very, visceral support among a chunk of our base. I think that will wane faster than he believes it will. Once you lose the trappings of office and the levers of power, and let's face it, Trumpism requires a certain swagger that comes with winning. And when you lose an election, and we've lost the House and the midterms, just lost the Senate, you kind of lose that swagger. And so I think that he'll fade away faster than many believe. But still, we have the problem that the base of the party might look for somebody just like him.
Well, this morning, though, he left on Air Force One to the tune of Frank Sinatra's My Way. And he said before he left, I'll be watching. We will be back in some form. And, you know, just in the minute or so we have, what does the party do? Do you How do you address both the white supremacists and neo-Nazis who wore, you know, Camp Auschwitz T-shirts in the Capitol, and the Americans who genuinely believed what they heard on the media outlets they listened to? What do you do?
You know, in the past, all the way back to Goldwater and William F. Buckley Jr. and Ronald Reagan, we were always able to sideline the fringe element, saying that that would be an irresponsible emblem. It's more difficult because it's a bigger chunk of the party now, let's face it. But that's what we have to do. I mean, we need to be a big tent party, but that tent can't include racists or those who believe in white supremacy. So we're going to have a reckoning coming forward, but I think we can do it.
You referred to the John Birch Society, which there was an attempt to sideline that years ago. Former Senator Jeff Flake, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Vice President Kamala Harris will preside over another swearing-in ceremony this afternoon at the Capitol for Georgia's two new senators, the Democrats Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff, the first Black and first Jewish senators from Georgia. Angie Maxwell is director of the Diane Blair Center of Southern Politics at the University of Arkansas. She joins us from Little Rock for a look at today through a politics lens. Hi, Angie.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. And comment on the two new senators first. This didn't happen out of thin air. Ossoff was a teenage intern for John Lewis, the Georgia congressman, the late civil rights hero. And after winning, Ossoff tweeted out, "And now a Jewish man that Lewis mentored and a Black man who was his pastor," meaning Raphael Warnock, "have been elected to represent the state of Georgia in the U.S. Senate." Just, you know, talk about, I mean, that's a lot of history combining for that moment.
It is. I'm struck today over and over again about, you know, the role that Black Southerners have played in what we witnessed today. I mean, this is the community that gave Joe Biden momentum in a crowded primary field. I think about the past generations of Black Southerners who worked with the Freedmen's Bureau in the aftermath of the Civil War to establish HBCUs like the great Howard University, where Vice President Kamala Harris received her undergraduate degree. And then, as you said, Black Southerners in Georgia 2 weeks ago made her one of the most powerful vice presidents in history by turning out in record numbers for Senators Warnock and Ossoff, which gives her the tie-breaking vote. A Senate that might get to increase stimulus money and take up legislation on voting rights. That they might, because of that tie and her tiebreaker vote, be able to pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Act is just an incredible testament to the work that has been done over generations.
Right. Well, and, you know, so what happens now? And by the way, you know, Black women like Stacey Abrams, the force behind that win. And one of my favorite moments, the force, one of my favorite moments after the election, I asked the CNN Black commentator, Bakari Sellers, you know, we were exploring how do we move forward with such a divide? And this was before the insurrection. How to heal. And he said, he was kind of perplexed. And he said, "Well, Black women just saved democracy in Georgia. I don't know what to tell you. I don't know what more we can do." In other words, it's not our job as African Americans. Whose is it? I just asked Republican former Senator Jeff Flake, who fixes this? Who heals this? Who tells, you know, two-thirds of Republicans this election was real?
Well, I don't think any one person heals it. I mean, I think what we learned from Stacey Abrams' example is you couldn't have had a better candidate in the Georgia's governor's race, a more talented candidate than Stacey Abrams. It's never one candidate. It's about the obstacles that get in our path to true representative democracy. Right. And she went about tearing those obstacles down without her name on the ballot. Right. And so what now we need to see is that, you know, unity will come when people in this country feel, you know, safe and secure and their right to vote is secure and the economy is back, you know, in better shape and we have access, equitable access to vaccines. I mean, it's not just going to be rhetoric. It's how people feel that government actually makes a difference in their lives for the better. And that comes with policy.
Yeah, healthcare is political. But again, absolutely. Harris and Biden sworn in today where these fault lines were laid bare. We saw people with Confederate flags and, you know, the battle for cap T-shirts that have signs on them saying battle for Capitol Hill veteran and MAGA Civil War are selling like hotcakes online. This administration faces a divided country. Let's hear Joe Biden in his inaugural address today.
And so today, at this time, in this place, let's start afresh, all of us. Let's begin to listen to one another again, hear one another, see one another, show respect to one another.
You know, such challenges, just your thoughts on what he faces.
Well, you know, his call for unity, I think, is a call for unity behind our institutions and how they were designed, you know, to work, and unity behind democracy. And that means we need to get rid of insult politics, right? That doesn't help. Mm-hmm. And a politics of kind of entertainment and outrage and the real work of government, which is deliverables to the American people that need them. And I feel like also what we have to, the thing that struck me over and over again as I watched the insurrection and the Confederate flag and all of it, it's like, what was at stake? What is deeper? What's behind that kind of racism? And I've watched since Obama's election, and it has seemed like it is a projection of sorts, very similar to what we saw in Reconstruction, right? That black leadership will do to whites what too much of white leadership did, you know, to African Americans, and that's not what we're going to see in this administration.
No. Angie Maxwell, we'll have to take this up again. She's director of the Diane Blair Center of Southern Politics at the University of Arkansas. In this moment where the South has seen some shifting, Professor Maxwell, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Well, for the first time in this nation's history, a woman now holds the office of vice president.
I, Kamala Davy Harris, do solemnly swear
that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
That I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Against all enemies.
As we've been talking about, Kamala Harris also becomes the first black woman and woman of Indian heritage in that post. And she was sworn in by another trailblazer, Justice Sonia Sotomayor, the first Latina on the Supreme Court. The magnitude of this moment is especially important for many people in this country who have been waiting, who have yearned for a government that reflects the diversity of America, a government that represents them. And that includes Manisha Sinha. She's a professor of American history at the University of Connecticut, and she joins me now on Skype. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, Manisha, you wrote this opinion piece in the New York Times last August, and in it you say, Kamala Harris is a personal gift to you. Can you say more?
Well, you know, as an Indian American immigrant who studies the history of slavery, abolition, Civil War, and Reconstruction, she symbolizes so many of those aspects of my life. So Joe Biden's selection of Kamala Harris as his vice president really resonated with me at a personal level, which took me by surprise, but also at a sort of broader professional level. The study of race in America is something that I have devoted my life to. In many ways, she spoke to both those aspects of my life, and I was tremendously pleased by her selection.
Harris's ability to ascend to her position follows, as we know, a long history of women who have tried to reach for higher positions in politics. How do you think Harris will shape the future for women ascending to higher positions of power, specifically in the political realm?
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, the fascinating thing about Kamala Harris is that she is a black woman. She is a woman of Indian American descent. But that did not deter her from seeking out the highest office in this country. You know, she ran for the presidency. And there's something inspiring about that, especially after 2016, when I think a lot of women across the United States were extremely upset at the defeat of Hillary Clinton in the Electoral College, even though she did get around 3 million more votes than Trump. And so I think it is an important symbol, not just for women of color and for, immigrant women, but also for women all across the United States. And the idea is that there's nothing untoward about women wanting to be politically ambitious or wanting to aspire to high office. Kamala Harris has been somewhat of a trailblazer throughout her life. You know, she was the first district attorney, woman of color, the first attorney general of California who was a woman. And then, of course, one of the few women senators and only the second black woman senator in our history. So her entire career has been somewhat backbreaking. And I think it does mean a lot to women, American women today.
You know, there was such hope in this country about us being in a post-racial society after Barack Obama became president. That didn't happen, of course. In fact, some have argued Trump's presidency was an overcorrection for a number of Americans. You know, a lot of people are pinning their hopes on the ability that Kamala Harris will get us to this place of unity. President Biden will do this as well. Do you think that's a flawed way of thinking? And I have only about 30 seconds with you to answer that, so I apologize.
All right. No worries. Well, you know, I think it is important to remember that nearly every kind of progress we have had in terms of black rights going back to the 19th century has been accompanied by a virulent backlash. And that is a constant struggle. It is a constant contestation. So these elections are not the end. They are the beginning of a very long fight. Joe Biden calls it the fight for the soul of America. But this effort to establish an interracial democracy is long and ongoing.
Yes. Manisha Sinha, professor of American history at the University of Connecticut, thank you so much.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. STM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Thursday, January 21st from 7 to 8 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
To become a world champion in freediving, Tanya Streeter learned to breathe like this. Ideas about air, breath, and breathing. That's on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
President Biden, in one of his first official acts, laid a wreath at the tomb of the unknown soldier today with former Presidents Bush, Clinton, and Obama. Earlier in his inaugural address, he focused on overcoming divisions.
We must end this uncivil war that pits red against blue.
Joining us now is NPR national political correspondent Don Gagne. Hey, Don, welcome back.
Hey. Hi, I'm glad to be here.
So we know that the presidential parade is happening right now. Tell us what you're seeing.
There's a military fife and drum corps walking past the White House. I am at a perch in a press viewing stand, literally right across the front of the White House. And this is the truncated version of that parade that would usually extend from Capitol Hill all the way down Pennsylvania Avenue to the White House. Now it's only about a block and a half long. It's going past the Treasury Building, past the White House. It will end with the new president and vice president, each being led by the drum lines from their respective alma maters. So we'll hear the University of Delaware marching band drum line, and we'll hear the great Howard University drum line. So all of that coming up in this relatively short, and mostly it's a military honor guard and color guard escort of the new occupants of the White House.
Yes, and probably what's different from other parades is that there are just not that many people who are there, right? 2 weeks ago, after pro-Trump rioting, Washington was basically fortified as a war zone. Is this a city that's ready to heed Biden's message of overcoming divisions?
Well, yeah, I guess it depends what you mean by Washington, right? You feel that the people of this city have certainly embraced Joe Biden and Kamala Harris as president and vice president and are quite excited to see them. You can feel that everywhere. If by Washington you mean the government and Congress particularly, that remains an open question. Now, look, there were many, many moments during the inaugural ceremony today that where you could certainly see President Biden reaching out to Republicans. And there was Mike Pence. Absent, of course, was former President Donald Trump. But other Republicans participated in the ceremony, and you know, they're visually at least looked like perhaps there's an opportunity. But, and this is a big but, we also have that impeachment trial looming over everything, and
that's
it will
right.
start in the United States Senate. We don't know exactly when, but potentially very soon.
Yeah. What's next on the president's agenda for the rest of the day today?
So he's already signed a whole slew of executive orders. So we don't need to parse all of those. But he will arrive, and he is going to kind of settle into the White House after, you know, taking part in this parade, which is going by right now. And there is a press briefing tonight, and it's getting to work right away.
Getting to work. Don Gagne is NPR's national political correspondent along the parade route in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
We want to reflect back on this day, the inauguration of President Biden and Vice President Harris, the 59th inaugural ceremony in American history. And we begin with Joe Biden swearing in as the 46th President of the United States.
Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts conducted the swearing-in ceremony. Biden placed his hand on a family Bible and recited the oath of office.
Please raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, Joseph Robinette Biden Jr., do solemnly swear. That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
President of the United States.
And will, to the best of my ability,
will, to the best of my ability,
preserve, protect, and defend,
preserve, protect, and defend
the Constitution of the United States.
Constitution of the United States.
So help you God.
So help me God.
Moments earlier, Kamala Harris was sworn in as vice president by Justice Sonia Sotomayor, becoming the first woman, the first black person, first Asian American to hold the office.
Please raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, Kamala Davy Harris, do solemnly swear.
I, Kamala Davy Harris, do solemnly swear.
That I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
That I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same.
That I take this obligation freely.
After both the president and vice president were sworn in, President Biden delivered his inaugural address to the American people. Looking out onto a sea of American flags waving in place of crowds that usually gather on the National Mall, Biden spoke of the fragility of democracy and pledged to seek unity in a moment of national crisis.
This is America's day. This is Democracy's Day, a day of history and hope, of renewal and resolve. Through a crucible for the ages, America has been tested anew, and America has risen to the challenge. Today, we celebrate the triumph not of a candidate, but of a cause, the cause of democracy. The people, the will of the people, has been heard. And the will of the people has been heeded. We've learned again that democracy is precious, democracy is fragile. And at this hour, my friends, democracy has prevailed. So now, on this hallowed ground where just a few days ago, violence sought to shake the Capitol's very foundation, we come together as one nation, under God, indivisible, to carry out the peaceful transfer of power as we have for more than two centuries. As we look ahead in our uniquely American way, restless, bold, optimistic, and set our sights on the nation we know we can be and we must be.
Well, next, Biden spoke of the great challenges ahead, a once-in-a-century pandemic that has already claimed more than 400,000 American lives, an unprecedented economic crisis, renewed calls for racial justice, and climate change.
In another January, on New Year's Day in 1863, Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation. When he put pen to paper, the president said, and I quote, "If my name ever goes down into history, it'll be for this act, and my whole soul is in it." My whole soul is in it. Today, on this January day, my whole soul is in this, bringing America together, uniting our people, uniting our nation. And I ask every American to join me in this cause. Uniting to fight the foes we face, anger, resentment and hatred, extremism, lawlessness, violence, disease, joblessness, and hopelessness. With unity, we can do great things, important things. We can right wrongs. We can put people to work in good jobs. We can teach our children in safe schools. We can overcome the deadly virus. We can reward work and rebuild the middle class and make health care secure for all. We can deliver racial justice, and we can make America once again the leading force for good in the world. I know speaking of unity can sound to some like a foolish fantasy these days. I know the forces that divide us are deep and they are real. But I also know they are not new. Our history has been a constant struggle between the American ideal that we're all are created equal and the harsh, ugly reality that racism, nativism, fear, demonization have long torn us apart. The battle is perennial, and victory is never assured. Through Civil War, the Great Depression, World War, 9/11, through struggle, sacrifice, and setbacks, our better angels have always prevailed.
Biden also took a moment to reflect on the progress we've made as a nation, pointing to history as a reminder that Americans can and have acted together for the greater good.
Just look around. Here we stand in the shadow of the Capitol Dome, as was mentioned earlier, completed amid the Civil War, when the Union itself was literally hanging in the balance. Yet we endured. We prevailed. Here we stand, looking out on the Great Mall, where Dr. King spoke of his dream. Here we stand, where 108 years ago, at another inaugural, thousands of protesters tried to block brave women marching for the right to vote. And today, we mark the swearing-in of the first woman in American history elected to national office, Vice President Kamala Harris. Don't tell me things can't change.
And in a direct rebuke to former President Trump, Biden pointed to the violent insurrection at the Capitol 2 weeks ago as a call to defend the truth and defeat the lies. And speaking directly to Trump supporters, Biden promised to be president for all Americans, not just those who voted for him.
Finally, before concluding his remarks, Biden asked the crowd to join him in a moment of silence to remember all of those who were lost to the coronavirus. And in closing, Biden promised to protect a democracy in peril and put the public good above all of his own personal interests.
we shall write an American story of hope, not fear, of unity, not division, of light, not darkness, a story of decency and dignity, love and healing, greatness and goodness. May this be the story that guides us, the story that inspires us, and the story that tells ages yet to come that we answered the call of history. We met the moment. Democracy and hope, truth and justice did not die in our watch but thrive. That America secured liberty at home and stood once again as a beacon to the world. That is what we owe our forebears, one another, and generation to follow. So, with purpose and resolve, we turn to those tasks of our time. Sustained by faith, driven by conviction, and devoted to one another and the country we love with all our hearts. May God bless America, and may God protect our troops. Thank you, America.
A few moments from this historic inauguration day and the inaugural address of now President Biden, as President Biden and First Lady Jill Biden walk down the street to the White House, which they will enter for the first time as President and First Lady. Joe Biden is now the 46th President of the United States, Kamala Harris, Vice President. They take office in the teeth of a pandemic that has killed more than 400,000 fellow Americans, and as many of their fellow Americans don't believe they are legitimate after the baseless claims led by former President Trump and leading Republicans.
Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, joins us now. And Julian, we come to you at the end of our Inauguration Day program. How are you viewing what happened today? How would you wrap up what we've seen today?
Well, this was the end of a tumultuous transition to power, unlike any we have seen in recent decades. But today we saw a sea change in the person holding the office of the presidency is someone who has who believes in the sanctity of the democracy and our institutions, and who has a serious commitment to governance. And that's an important change after the last 4 years.
Yeah, well, Julian, Tanya and I have both been stuck today at many times on how do we go forward after, you know, the division that was laid bare in the insurrection 2 weeks ago. In Biden's inaugural, it was a plea for unity. You know, on that same spot where the insurrection happened, let's listen.
We must end this uncivil war that pits red against blue, rural versus urban, conservative versus liberal. We can do this if we open our souls instead of hardening our hearts, if we show a little tolerance and humility.
Julian Zelizer, beautiful language, but we've reflected back today on the Reconstruction post-Civil War that papered over, you know, injustices. And, you know, there are historians saying we can't do that again. What happens now?
I think that's important. I think there is a big obligation for President Biden and Vice President Harris to deal with the many injustices and abuses of power that we've seen. If you just move forward, you don't heal the nation. You leave all these problems festering. And the reality is, as beautiful as the speech might have been, starting today, President Biden is going to encounter the same Republican Party. He's going to have to work in the same media ecosystem, and he's going to have many of the same difficulties that the person he worked for, President Obama, faced after he made his famous speech about this not being a red or blue America.
You know, Julian, we've been talking a lot about how Kamala Harris made her own history today, and we've been just talking about her role overall. We don't often talk about the vice presidents so much when we're talking about the inaugural process. What role do you expect her to play in the Biden administration?
A very big role. Other than a handful of vice presidents like Dan Quayle, since the 1970s, all vice presidents are important. They're all influential, and there's no reason to think that she won't be. She's also a very talented and important figure within the Democratic Party. So I think the administration will want to use her and include her as much as possible for her expertise and her political savvy. And finally, President Biden was a vice president, and he was one who played an important role in the Obama years. So I think he's going to appreciate what it means to have a true partnership. So I think she will be a very important player starting right now and through the rest of this presidency.
Well, and Julian, as we know, President Trump didn't attend the inauguration. He did speak at Joint Base Andrews before leaving Washington for the last time as president. Let's listen.
I wish the new administration great luck and great success. I think they'll have great success. They have the foundation to do something really spectacular.
And as you watch this day, as an historian, I was thinking, first of all, how could he possibly have attended when you looked at the camaraderie between different party members there at the inauguration? And he exits with, this terribly low approval rating. Is history already been written here?
Well, there's always room for new perspectives on a president. I'm always hesitant to have a final conclusion. But as of now, from where we sit, I think this will be remembered as 4 years of immense political instability, vanishing norms and eroded institutions, as well as a pretty sharp rightward shift on many issues such as deregulation, climate change, other questions on the economy. And also, he will be remembered as a twice impeached president, and most important, a failed pandemic policy. I think all of this will be part of how we write of his presidency.
Yeah, there's so much here, including the impeachment trial that will be coming up pretty soon. Thank you so much, Julian Zelizar, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, talking about today's inauguration and putting in historical context what we see today and what we're expecting in the future. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.